An actor would realize that he's very pivotal in the picture, and he, in the midst of all that tension and suspense and stuff, he is
the comic relief,
and who doesn't like comic relief, especially in a good picture that's where the audience needs a chance to take a deep breath and sort of refocus themselves. Fail-proof, almost,
also, I'm wondering if
in my hands.
Thinking from your own experience with the little speech you get from the bench about growing up in Watts as opposed to growing up here, the way language...
Well, there are certain similarities I recognize in the guy, and so I sort of knew. I mean, I've met people like that. I've never met a justice quite like that, but I've met powerful black men who somehow can hold on to their roots and use their experiences on the street to... I've met some pimps who would make wonderful producers. Seriously, I mean, they'd sell their mother to get the show on.
So you can speak a little bit about the character. I mean, someone who has such expertise and moral values and yet has a character flaw. And
that makes him interesting to me. One of the reasons I never got into those blaxploitation pictures in the 70s was because I didn't know how to play those characters. I mean, those men were so much larger than life. I mean, a tear would never possibly darken their cheek. They had no real relationships with women. As far as I could see, no real feelings. They didn't seem human to me, so I didn't know really how to play them. That's the reason. It wasn't because of any great social consciousness on my part. I just simply did not know how to play these kind of men. I never met them, for one thing. And I mean, their solution to problems was to shoot a helicopter out of the sky. I just never run across those chaps. I take that back. No, that's true. I've never had socially or otherwise, I never met a black justice before this picture.
In preparation for this picture, did you meet some?
Yes, Alan Pakula insisted that we get paid for a 3.5-week rehearsal to do research. Not much, but but I was fortunate enough to meet two wonderful justices here in New York. One a Supreme Court judge, and Justice Bruce Wright, who wrote a book called Black Robes, White Justice, and who is in some ways very similar to my character in the sense that he had moved up the judicial corporate ladder and had got about as far as you can go and had been accepted as he is, a brilliant jurist and very literate, very witty human being, and was respected as such until he started criticizing the New York judicial system and how it was sort of predisposed from a white point of view to willy-nilly condemn blacks to that they're guilty before they arrive, that they didn't have the means to really defend themselves, and that our system was flawed. That got him into a great deal of trouble, and he has been since sort of shunted into a sort of judicial backwater. The tabloids called him Cut Him Loose Bruce because they thought he wasn't hard enough on people. It's all right for criminals, quote, to complain about the criminal system, but for a judge on the other side to say this is not working, and a black one at that, dangerous territory. And I talked to other judges who certainly knew and had and have the specter of justice right before their eyes and know exactly what they can do and where they can also go wrong. If you want to be inducted or accepted into that powerful old boy judicial network, you have to give up something. You have to give up part of your blackness, your culture, your history, your street smarts, your something in order to fit in. You can't talk that way at these powerful cocktail parties around the golf course with the right people. It's a price you pay, and sometimes you keep paying. There was a judge, however, in Detroit. I talked to about five judges in Detroit. I talked to judges who had read the book and those who hadn't. The ones who had read the book, I asked them about my character. Those who hadn't, I just simply asked them about their lives and how they survived and blah, blah, blah. But one judge said, well, why don't you come up with me on the bench? I said, oh. Came up, he introduced me to the litigants and said, there's this actor here from Hollywood who's doing some research on a movie. And if you don't mind being pleading a case in front of him, we'll go at it. And no one turned us down. They all, I guess, thought they could, there's this asshole from Hollywood, I can get away with murder.
Literally.
What sort of cases did you preside?
They weren't life and death cases. They were not felony cases. They were a mixture of more than traffic court, but civil disturbance, disturbing the peace, people beating up each other. What is that called? Whatever.
Domestic
violence, things like that. But with life and death enough for these people to have to spend all day in court. We would listen to the case, and he'd say, well, Paul, okay, what do you think? I said, well, obviously, this person is telling the truth. I mean, I let him have my money. I mean, you know, this person is scum of the earth, no doubt about it. And he said, well, yeah, but Paul, don't you remember when that he said this, and doesn't that sort of conflict with what these other witnesses said, and blah, 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 blah. At any rate, it dawned on me that there is a special way of listening, another way of listening that I was not aware of, that, that I guess jurists have a way of sort of balancing facts and listening to germane, how people talk. I don't know. I wish I did know. But it's. But the important thing was, for me, that when I got into my own bailiwick at Astoria Studios on that enormous throne 40 feet high with a big mural behind it and this whole thing and don those black robes, I didn't have to try to imagine what it was like. I didn't have to try to conjure up in my mind that kind of power, that kind of responsibility, that kind of awesomeness, really.
What does it? Is it the height?
Where you may have noticed, they always raised above, I guess to be objective, to see it all from a different point of view, I don't know. But it does, you're looking up, you're looking up, you're looking up. This is where the truth is coming from.
Did you get to know Harrison Ford at all? I mean, what is your impression of him as a colleague?
Well, actually, I met Harrison Ford in 1964. We were both under contract to Columbia on Sunset and Gower.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was brought in because of the Watts riots. The studios said, well, look, there must be a story here. And all of these riots and the blacks uprising, the civil rights movement. We're going to need some angry black young men to play these roles, and so I was sort of. I had been through college. I was a trained actor. I got a contract. It was the end of that era. I mean, where the contract players, you know, we got like I don't know $200 a week and all the free movies you could watch. Few acting lessons and stuff like that. It wasn't anything great or grand, but some of the other actors thought it was very great and very grand. But Harrison was my only friend. I mean, he was the only one who would deem to sort of take me at face value, and we became very good friends. He was, as then, really a breath of fresh air, very, very non-judgmental in his dealings with people. I think he's very open and accept you for who and what you are. Our careers took very different paths. I went on to join a repertory company at Stanford. He and Frankovich didn't get along too well, And he went on to become a contractor and I think pump gas and did whatever he had to do to feed his wife and kid. And then when his career took off several years after that, my agent, as a matter of fact, just mentioned him. He said, you know, Harrison came to our office and wanted to be. I looked at him and he said, just another dime a dozen white actor. Just he's been kicking himself ever since. But he's... it was very, very nice to sort of, after 25 years or so, to come full circle and sort of from different doors perhaps come in more or less as survivors of a very long time in Hollywood.
He hasn't changed?
Well, I think if you're managing half a state, like Montana, a ranch, and half of Hollywood... certain things change. Your perspective might be a little different. But basically, I don't think the human being inside has changed very much. No. He's a much better actor. That has changed. I think he's brilliant in this movie. It's very hard to do, just listen and react. He doesn't have that many lines. But he is the whole matrix of this picture, and he holds it together very well, I think. All the actors were very intent and focused in on getting it right, true to the book. I mean, we literally had the novel in one hand and the screenplay in the other, and we come in the next morning and one actor said, you know, I was rereading this section in the book, and it says in this scene, and I say this, and I think this scene is much more, illuminates my character more, and it's says it's better than it does in the screenplay. And he had actually said, well, wait a minute, if we cut that scene, that's my big scene, and I'm, you know. But there was no egotism. There was no self-interest. It was really, we were all willing to get, if it moved the story forward, if it made it clearer, and if it was truer to the book, that's what we all settled on. I've never had an experience quite like that. Either the director makes the decisions from the get-go, or the screenwriter says, this is the way you do it. But it was a real input. The script was being worked on right up to the very last day, trying to make it better.
Courtroom scenes are such a standard or staple of films and television. Take us through this one. Was it shot roughly with the same order of events, or was it all out of sequence? Did you do it all at once, that sort of thing?
They did all of the exterior stuff. The courtroom, as in the book, was left for last. When the first day of court was the first day that I started working. They did all the other stuff. That's not quite true. I did the other stuff with Brian and some of the other stuff before, but I really started working as the first day of court, and the final day of the shooting was the final day of when the gavel came down as the court, the case dismissed.
Is it less fragmented than shooting
yes,
otherwise?
Yes, and it's very helpful, I think, for actors generally, because it's like a play. It sort of unfolds before you. You sort of go through the experience. You don't have to sort of like plan ahead how I'm going to react to something you don't know that's happened yet. And you are able to build a suspense, I think, a lot more when it's sort of revealed in front of you. You do your own suspension of belief and you pretend like you've heard it for the first time. They say, oh, because it is the first time you've heard it, really.
In a way, what I got from the book, too, is that trials are so pre-prepared.
They try to be.
They are so worked out in advance that the trial itself is almost an afterthought away.
A kind of ritual dance,
yeah.
As it were.
Yeah.
Well, there are always a few surprises, though. Even the best laid plans, I mean, I don't know what happened during the Imelda Marcos trial, but same as a shock to me. Well, it's always different. I was very well received in Detroit, but in Atlanta, when I was researching Dr. King, it was a little bit different. No, a lot of people were very helpful, but the person I really wanted to talk to was his father. And the only chance they could sort of like schedule me into his, or segue me into his schedule, was he had sort of a ritual Sunday brunch in a hotel restaurant. Near an airport restaurant, somewhere near Atlanta. Enormous place, very popular. And he has an enormous table. His family is always there. And people would come up and pay their respects, white, black, young, old. And I was sitting next to him, but he was mostly dealing with his public. A very grand seigneur sort of man. And finally, around dessert time, whoever I was with said, Reverend King, this is Paul Winfield, who is going to play your son in the picture that we're doing, and if you could give him a few minutes, he'd like to ask you a few questions about, my hair was a little long, I had a beard, I wasn't, you know, looking like King at that time, and he sort of gave me, sort of finally brought the full force of his gaze over to me and looked me up and down and said, well, and I says, well, anything you can tell me, you know, would be very helpful, or his childhood, or what he was like in school, what kind of student he was, although I knew most of these things. Did you have to discipline him very much? And he just sort of said, well, there was only one Martin. End of conversation. What, say again?
What did you key on to play Dr. King? Any aspect in particular of his personality?
Sure. I tried to make him as human as I could. There was a lot of pressure and a lot of people who were very, for whatever reasons, wanted to make him into a saint from the get-go. Not that he may not have been one, but that somehow he was... came out of his mother's womb a perfect human being. He's a gifted, intellectual, talented, charismatic man, but he had his flaws like anybody else. We had the biggest flack from Reverend Lowry, from Jesse Jackson, from several people.
But not Abernathy.
And Abernathy as well.
And Abernathy.
Particularly about one scene, the first time he's arrested, and in his own biography he says he was scared to death. He didn't even know where the jail was, but he certainly knew enough about Birmingham to know that people went in there and didn't come out whole or healthy. And he was frightened. And we felt it was important to show him being frightened, maybe even wimpish, as they said. but the point was that maybe he was frightened, but the point was that he went on to be arrested over 120 more times, that it didn't stop him, that these obstacles put before you are there for you to use and to grow from, to overcome, to use, that no one is... He was like a reluctant, I mean, he was sort of dragged into this whole thing from the beginning. He was a reluctant leader. I don't think he really relished being a spokesman. I think, and at the end of his life, he was literally running from one bushfire to another, trying to put them out. The whole movement was totally fragmented. I mean, he'd come out against Vietnam, against Johnson, and Johnson took it very personally. I mean, it was like, I mean, the man... Well, Kennedy couldn't, but Johnson got the Civil Rights Bill through, not Kennedy. It was, and our best friend, and you're turning on him? I mean, everybody was against King at that time. And Johnson also felt personally hurt and jilted and rejected. He was at his, nearly at his lowest, I guess. But all of those things we tried to put into the piece. When I finally done what I guess every actor is supposed to do, is do a Broadway play. Boy, No, it was a good play. It was one of those actor's dreams. I mean, in terms of Denzel Washington and I did a play in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, at a Equity Waiver Theater, 99-seat house, as a favor to Woody King, the producer, director, and the playwright. He just wanted like 9 performances of this thing, and just to see what it was like on his feet. I said, okay, sure, we aren't doing anything. We did a play, became a tremendous runaway hit. We ran at that theater for 2 months or something, moved to the Westwood Playhouse, much larger theater. Ran for almost 9 months until maybe longer. I know we've gone into the television season, and Denzel was doing Hill Street Blues, I was doing a series called The Charmings, so we're doing working in the daytime and the night. Finally, it just got to be too much. We closed the play down. They decided to bring it to New York. We did. It was cream by the critics. I'll never forget what Frank Rich said, or forgive him. But the point was, it was very well received by the black community. It ran for 9 months at the 42nd Street Theater, which was about 1,500 seats, big musical theater house. We kept it open for 9 months, sold out houses. They had to have them sold out for what Denzel was asking. and with no advertisements. I mean, we did not advertise in the New York Times.